everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. How are you today on this December 3rd, 2013? It's a really nice day here in New York City. It's a little cool, but not too cool. And I'm just chilling here. Thanks for joining me. It's Giving Tuesday. And I think we'll talk a little bit about more about Giving Tuesday later, what that is and what you might do about it. But right now I want to bring on my first guest, Nick Cooney. He is the author of Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. He's the founder and chairman of the board of the Humane League, a vegan advocacy and farm animal protection organization. He works for animals. His work for animals has been featured in hundreds of media outlets, including Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, and he's got a new book called Veganomics, and we're going to be attacking that today. Welcome to It's All About Food, Nick.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for writing that book. Thanks for giving us all of that information. I'm going to be kind of highlighting giving today. It's Giving Tuesday. And you gave us a lot of great information. But before we start talking about your book, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. It was very good. It was with my family, and while they are still eating meat themselves, they're not vegetarian. It was a table with about 12 or 13 vegan dishes and then one little tub of turkey. So, pretty good on their part. So I had a nice Thanksgiving. Thanks.
Very nice. Well, my partner Gary and I made a decision this year that we wanted to stay home, and that kind of generated a little trouble with my parents because they wanted to have everybody together in one place with my brother's family and some other families. And we just this year wanted to make our own food and enjoy it and see what happens. And for 2 days, we cooked with so much joy and no stress. It was just like this zen experience. And the last minute, we invited some people over. And we ended up having this wonderful party from 5 to like 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning. The food lasted until yesterday. And it was one of the best Thanksgivings I ever had.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Well, we might get into talking about the social aspects of being vegetarian and vegan. I'm sure you've got some numbers on it, but let's jump into your book. I love data. I come from a science background myself, and I love collecting data and analyzing it, and that's what you did in this book, Veganomics.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically the point of writing the book was there's hundreds and hundreds of studies out there on vegetarians and vegans themselves, but also on people who just want to try vegetarian meals, cut back on the meat consumption. There's actually hundreds of studies on these individuals, who they are, why they do it, the impact it has on them and on the world. They're kind of buried in obscure academic journals and other places like that. So I kind of wanted to go through the scientific record and find every survey and study that I could uncover and see what does that tell us, both in terms of things that could be interesting to us, whether we're vegan, vegetarian, cutting back on our meat consumption, or just know someone who is. So interesting in that regard, but also useful to those who may want to motivate others to make some of those same compassionate changes in their diet. So that was the whole point of the book. And yeah, it's definitely a data-based book.
Well, I think it's useful for a lot of reasons. Certainly companies or people that have businesses that want to target vegetarians, this is a great marketing tool.
And yeah, I've had some great interest in it from a few vegetarian meat producers who think the data in there could be useful to them. So I'm happy to hear that.
Absolutely. And then for some of us who have been vegan for like forever, or it seems like it, it's just great to be able to reflect for a moment to see where the world is today compared to where it was 25 years ago. And a lot has happened, and that's good.
You're right. You know, there is a lot of good happening. Americans really are starting to change their diet. I mean, just in the past 7 years alone, if we look at USDA data, the average per capita meat consumption in the U.S. has dropped by 10%. And that may sound like a fairly small number, and certainly, you know, I hope that that number grows. But just that change alone over the past 7 years does two things. First, it reversed about a 30-year trend of year-over-year, in general, increasing per capita meat consumption in our country. And the other thing it did is just in the past 7 years, as a result of that change, the number of animals being raised on these really, you know, filthy, confining, cruel factory farms and farms in general, the number of animals being raised and killed in these places has dropped by about half of a billion, just because of this reduction in average meat consumption. So it really is, we really are starting to see kind of a sea change in how we as Americans eat.
Well, 10%, it's not a big number, but it's significant. And when businesses or politicians see numbers like that, they notice and say, I've got to start paying attention and making some changes.
That is definitely the case. You know, just last week we had the Washington Post releasing the news that Al Gore is the latest celebrity to have gone vegan himself. So, yeah, they're definitely paying attention, both in their politics, I think, and also for some of them anyway, in their own personal lives.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to hear more about Al Gore and his move, although everybody seems to be quoting this Forbes magazine one-line statement, and I'm waiting to hear some more juicy, meaty details.
Absolutely.
But it's not about celebrities, although celebrities certainly help and politicians help when they move toward a plant-based diet and make some really sensible choices. So I applaud them when they do that, and it's about time, Al.
Yeah. I mean, for years, obviously, he's been one of the most prominent voices for, against, you know, climate change.
Climate change, hello.
Certainly it's great that he's finally on board with addressing his own life in terms of one of the biggest things that each one of us contributes to climate change, which is, of course, our diet and the amount of meat we consume.
So you have a very positive spin pretty much throughout this book, which I appreciated. I like to accent the positive and eliminate the negative, and I'm not going to jump out in song right now. That's for later.
Great.
I don't know if you know that song, but
I hope I'm still on the line when that happens.
Anyway, I'm digressing. But you talk about all the different things that are good because it causes a reduction in animals being killed and less meat being consumed. So, for example, we talk about, we in the veg world, about those folks who choose to eat free range or humanely, quote, humanely, air quotes, humanely raised meat. And it's frustrating. In fact, I was talking to Hope Bohanic recently with her new book, The Ultimate Betrayal, and she's arming people with all kinds of responses when they ask, is it okay to eat organic or free range meat? And you have kind of a different spin on it, how overall these folks are more receptive to the vegetarian message and they're eating less meat in general.
Yeah, so I think to tease out a couple of things there, yes, it, if we look to the data and the surveys, they do suggest that people who are concerned with and eating, you know, quote-unquote free-range meat or cage-free eggs or such, these products that either have slightly higher welfare or at least claim to have slightly higher welfare, that those people are more open to going vegetarian and going vegan. They are more likely to eventually make those changes. So, and I think that speaks to the fact that these are individuals who, you know, perhaps some of them are just kind of jumping on a trendy bandwagon, but certainly a lot of them want to, you know, they care about farm animals.
Right.
Like most people, they don't want animals to suffer unnecessarily. And so their understanding is that by switching to free range or cage free, they're now eating animals that lived a good, happy life, at least up until the day that they were killed. And so it's coming from a compassionate concern. Now, of course, as we know, the unfortunate reality is that most of these farms are only very, very slightly better than the standard industrial farm. And so the unfortunate reality is that most animals on these farms are still living a life of day-to-day absolute misery. And I think that's why that when these individuals then learn the reality of how animals are treated, even on cage-free or free-range farms, many of them are then willing to change their diet. So I think they're compassionate people who just, you know, again, need to, like all of us, learn more of the reality of what's going on.
All the more reason to be loving, non-judgmental, and compassionate to everyone, because you never know when today's sensitive, free-range, humanely grown meat eater might be a potential vegetarian tomorrow.
Oh, of course. And I'm sure you could roll off lots of people that we know who certainly fell into that very pattern.
Yeah. Okay. Now, but you talk about learning and education, and there were some interesting things that I wanted to talk about, because some of them, maybe I read it wrong, but some of them kind of go against each other. So I've certainly read some of the studies that you've highlighted where high IQ, very intelligent children tend to become vegetarian more than the average, and those who are high IQ or highly educated also tend to become vegetarian more than average. But on the other hand, there are many, many educated people who tend to eat more meat than those who have less schooling.
Yeah.
So those were some really fascinating nuggets there. Can you digest them for me?
Yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy, and I think the reason is this. So we do see, both if we look at children and if we look at adults, that there is a correlation between diet and IQ. And those who have higher IQs when they're younger and those who have higher IQs when they're older are both more likely to be vegetarian. And vegetarians, on average, have a higher IQ level than meat eaters. So that connection is definitely there. It's been shown in a number of studies anyway. But then the reason that things get tricky when we look at education overall is that, just because those with a higher IQ are more likely to go vegetarian, there's going to be competing factors as well. So when it comes to education level overall, if we look at all those who have higher education and perhaps have a higher IQ as well, many of them go on to have higher paying jobs. And as income goes up, meat consumption tends to go up as well. And so that's why if we look at those who are more educated overall, we have that kind of ironic juxtaposition of a higher percentage of them being vegetarian, but among those who eat meat, the average meat consumption is higher than it would be for those of lower education and therefore those of lower income as well. So it's kind of a number of demographic factors that interplay in interesting ways when it comes to diet.
Yeah, and I think it fits in with when you talked about countries that have very little or they don't have the income gap, let's say, so the very poor versus the very rich. The range is there's no big gap in the middle. They tend to promote more equality with humans and with animal species and are more likely to eat less meat. And the countries, unfortunately, like the United States more and more, where there's this big gap between the rich and the poor, the educated and the rich tend to really indulge themselves and eat a lot of meat.
Yeah, that was one of the fascinating findings from the research.
That's very fascinating.
So as I talk about in the book, if you pick the 20 or 25 high-income countries around the world, so of course the U.S., Canada, Germany, so England, so forth, and you put all those names of those countries into a hat, and then you pulled two countries out of the hat, and you looked at how much the average wage earner in each of those countries earned, you could not predict from that how much meat is going to be in that country. But if you look at the distribution of wealth in that country, so whether there is an equal roughly equal distribution of wealth, or whether there's those wide gaps between the rich and the poor, that can predict how much meat people eat in those countries. Those countries that are more egalitarian, that have stronger social welfare systems, that basically, display more social concern for the poor and the disadvantaged, those countries are also have lower per capita meat consumption than countries with more of a me, everyone look out for themselves sort of attitude, which is very interesting to see that, again, those that concern for people, that social concern, ties in very much with concern for animals and not wanting to cause them harm.
Right. And you also pointed out, I just keep connecting dots here. One thing leads to the next. So many times people have pointed their finger at vegetarians saying, why do you care so much about the animals? You should care about the people. But your data shows that those who care about animals care about people, probably more so than those who don't care about animals. It's all one big compassionate package.
Yeah, that's right. There are studies where the researchers have put omnivores, vegans, and vegetarians into fMRI machines and showed them images of either humans or animals in neutral situations, but also in distressing situations. Those who are in trouble or hurt or injured or something like that. And then they took fMRI scans of the brains of these individuals as they were seeing these images. And they found that, lo and behold, vegetarians and vegans had more activation in the parts of the brain associated with an empathetic response than did the omnivores, which leads the researchers to conclude that, you know, perhaps vegetarians and vegans have more empathy and more concern, not just for animals, of course, but also for other human beings. And in fact, a number of written studies and questionnaires have found the same thing. So that when people fill out questionnaires that are designed to measure empathy levels and answer a range of questions about, you know, their thoughts in the world and how they live their life, vegetarians and vegans have consistently been shown to have higher levels of empathy. And in fact, as you go up the empathy scale, with each step you go up the scale, the kind of standard empathy scale that researchers use, with each step you go up the scale, your likelihood of being vegetarian doubles. So there is a very strong connection between empathy and altruism and vegetarian or vegan eating.
Okay, so I'm feeling very smug right now and very holier than thou. Because I'm a quarter century old vegan, and I do it for a lot of different reasons. Firstly, for the animals, and then all the other bonuses that come with it. It's great for my health and great for the environment, and et cetera, et cetera. But according to a lot of data, if we're eating a healthy vegan diet, we do better than Americans on a standard American diet health-wise and quality of life-wise. There's all kinds of winning points for this lifestyle. But you mentioned that vegetarians are more depressed. What's that about?
This is true.
I'm depressed hearing this.
It is unfortunate, right? So it's not at least it does not seem from the research, it does not seem like the depression or the anxiety are results of the diet. In fact, quite the opposite. It seems like once people go vegetarian or vegan, their spirits and mood actually improves. But it does seem that people who are prone to depression and anxiety and experience those things and have those issues are more likely to go on to become vegetarian themselves or vegan themselves. And while there's not research on this at this point, my conjecture on it is perhaps that, you know, because of the suffering that they experience, that maybe have heightened sensitivity towards others who are suffering, whether it's other people or animals.
Right.
And perhaps that's part of the reason that they're just more open to these ideas, more willing to identify with others in pain, and therefore more likely to go vegetarian themselves. And then again, the good news is that once they do it, there are studies that show that eating vegetarian, even for those who don't suffer depression or anxiety or any mental health issue, that eating vegetarian increases mental happiness and energy and mental spirits in general.
And maybe some of those folks, before they became vegetarian and had issues with depression, were because they had a great deal of empathy and realized how sick the world can be and how violent it is, and the fact that we don't have control over it can be very depressing.
That could definitely be the case, yeah. And sensitivity to those things could certainly both cause depression and also cause vegetarianism.
Right. And what I like about, personally, my vegan lifestyle is I know I can't control many things out there, but I do have control over my own life, and I don't want to bring violence into my life. I don't want to eat violence. I don't want to support exploitation. And I'm not a perfect person, and sometimes I discover that some product I might have bought is associated with sweatshops or something, and I'm not very happy about it. So, you know, I'm doing the best that I can, but we have control over our own lives, and that's where this vegan lifestyle is so important.
Yeah, you know, it is great to be able to do something that we know has a positive impact on so many individuals. And I look at the numbers on this a bit in the book and try to see, you know, if we look at the USDA data, how many animals do we actually spare from not just, a painful and brutal death, but also a lifetime of day-to-day misery and cramped confinement. And, you know, the good news in terms of us being able to make a positive difference in the world is that we really do make a big impact. As I mentioned, the fact that average meat consumption has gone down has led there to be 500 million fewer animals being raised and killed in the U.S. And if we look at this on an individual level, just cutting chicken alone out of your diet, even after you account for, you know, supply and demand curves and, you know, the price elasticity of these different products and, you know, all the other economic factors, just cutting chicken alone out of your diet, if you're the average American meat eater, will spare about 21 chickens a year from a lifetime of misery. It's 21 individuals who are just as intelligent and emotionally capable as probably the cat or dog that you have at home, or at least close to that. And going fully vegetarian will spare about 23 animals a year from this lifetime of day-to-day misery. And so this is a situation where each one of us does have an awful lot of power. We may not be able to change the entire food system, but there are dozens of individuals, you know, smart, friendly individuals if we met them, you know, we would want to pet them and we would want to hang out with them and get our picture taken with them. We can spare dozens of them a year ourselves just by choosing a different, equally tasty, probably even more healthy option when we sit down to eat.
Chickens make up the biggest number of animals that are being killed for food. People don't realize that.
That's correct. You know, we typically think cow, you know, the quintessential American farm animal. But in reality, the number of cows being raised is in the tens of millions in the U.S. The number of chickens is somewhere around over 7 billion per year.
Yeah, it's huge, especially since chickens weren't something that people really went to as their go-to meat, maybe, I don't know how many, 100 years ago or more. And here in the United States, people have been manipulated, once again, marketed, and told that chicken is the food to eat, to a point where doctors recommend chicken and fish over beef today because, for health reasons, they say beef isn't healthy, but lean chicken and fish are. And they're wrong on all of that. None of it's healthy. At least not in large quantities. We don't know if a little bit is good or not good, but not in the amounts that Americans are eating today.
Right, and this trend that had been going on for decades of moving from red meat towards chicken has really had devastating consequences when it comes to animal welfare and the amount of suffering in this country and on this planet. So even though Americans are eating only, about 20% more meat today than they were in the 1950s, I may be a bit off, but it's roughly in that range. Even though those in the Western world are only eating about 20% more meat today than they were in the 1950s, the number of farm animals being raised and killed today compared to the 1950s is a several-fold increase. Because people are have switched from these bigger animals like cows that you can get many meals out of to smaller animals like chicken, which, you know, have very little meat on their bones. So the number of animals being raised and killed for food in this country has skyrocketed because of somewhat of a public shift towards chicken. Now, thankfully, in the past 6 or 7 years, we've seen even chicken, per capita chicken consumption starting to drop off. It's dropped off, I think, about 78% over the past 7 years. So we are seeing a shift in that regard. You know, one thing I point out in the book is that for those who, you know, care about animals and want to prevent them from suffering, but don't feel they could go fully vegetarian right now, the best first step to make is really not to go switch to free range or anything like that, rather than just cut out chicken as your first step. Because just by cutting out chicken, regardless of the rest of what you do with your diet, just by cutting out chicken, you'll spare up to a couple dozen animals per year from misery. And so that's really a great first step for those who want to help animals but don't think they could go fully vegetarian at this point.
I'm wondering if you came up with this expression, but a lot of people talk about having a sweet tooth, and you say that Americans have a meat tooth.
I don't know of anyone else having used it, so perhaps I coined that term in the book. But we have the highest per capita meat consumption of any country on earth. You know, in the book, I note that the tiny country of Luxembourg is the only one that actually eats a bit more. But this fall, I actually was in Luxembourg, and I found out that that's quite misleading because half or a third of the population there, the people eating food there, don't actually live there. They just come in, work there during the day, eat, and then leave. And so it kind of distorts the data. So the real reality is that America does have the highest per capita meat consumption of any country on the planet right now.
Whoa. Well, yeah. There yeah. You go. Well, where can people find out more about Veganomics and you, Nick Cooney?
Sure. So the book itself, you can check out veganomicsbook.com and read some sample chapters, see more what the book is about, and if you're interested, certainly can order it. And my information is up there as well. So if anyone wants to get in touch, my email address is on the site. Again, it's veganomicsbook.com.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you so much for writing this book. I really enjoyed getting all of those numbers together and kind of confirmed a lot of things that I had already felt was true, but it's great to have a resource to go to and say, see, it is true.
Hey, well, thanks so much for having me on and for doing your show.
Okay. And now maybe I'll sing a verse of Accentuate the Positive. What do you think of that?
That sounds wonderful.
So we started this group, my partner Gary and I, called the Swingin' Gourmets, and we have put together a vegan cabaret musical, and we've started to present it there, here, and there, and we're working more on it. And the point of it is to put a very positive, joyful spin on eating plant foods, because it is so loving and joyful, and although there's a lot of horrible things that we talk about, because there's a lot of horrible things going on in the world, I personally like to focus on all the benefits and the joys. And we put together this show. We tell a few stories in it, and it's really fun. You can learn more about it at swingandgourmets.com. But we took one of these songs, Accentuate the Positive, and we sing a little of it. You've got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. And that's just a little tease. I'm not going to sing anymore, but if you want to know more about the Swing Gourmets and hear us sing this tune, you'll have to contact me at that website. Anyway, Nick, thanks for joining me, and all the best to you with your book. We're going to take a little break and bring on our next guest in a little bit. But before we go, I wanted to just talk a minute about Giving Tuesday. So this is a day on December 3rd where after Thanksgiving, where we eat a lot, and then a couple of days later where apparently we consume a lot going to stores, the 92nd Y here in New York City came up with this concept of Giving Tuesday, where people have the opportunity to give to a bunch of organizations that are on the Giving Tuesday website. And just think about giving as we head into the bigger holidays coming on later this year. And I like the concept. Personally, I think every day should be a giving day, not just this one Tuesday. And it's wonderful to give to all kinds of charitable organizations. But financial giving is not the only way to give. You can give of yourself, your time, volunteering, your love, your compassion. There are so many different ways to give. And we may talk about that a little bit in the next portion of this show, where we're going to be talking about effortless meditation. But when we take a little break, just think about giving. It's such a wonderful thing, because we find that when we give, we get back a lot more. And that's not really the motivation behind it, of course, but it's just a wonderful benefit. Okay, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on December 3rd, 2013. Now I want you to take some good, low, deep breaths in, out. We're going to be doing a lot of breathing this next half hour, I think. Breathing is really good. I really enjoy it. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't breathing. All right, we're going to bring on my next guest, Ajahn Boris. He has been exploring and teaching a variety of meditation practices since 1970. In his younger life, he studied in residence under Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, founder of the Transcendental Meditation Program, and spent a decade teaching the TM program. In the mid-90s, he studied with India's most widely revered contemporary female saint known as the Hugging Saint, Amachi, serving as the meditation teacher at her ashram in Kerala, India. He also spent time with holy men and yogis in the Himalayas of the Uttaranchal, a haven for saints throughout the ages, where he researched the spiritual practices indigenous to that area. And he's a registered hypnotherapist, Reiki master, certified anagram teacher. He is the author of Effortless Mind, Meditate with Ease, which we're going to be talking about today, as well as a number of other books. Welcome to It's All About Food, Ajahn.
Thank you so much, Karen. Great to be here.
Yes. Well, first I wanted to tell you, I talked about earlier in the show that I was so energized and feeling really good, and I want to tell you why, because I just read your book earlier today, and the whole time I'm reading it, I kept saying, I want to do my yoga practice, and I want to jump into my meditation practice, and I just felt, I had this image almost of like a dog holding a leash waiting to go for a walk with great anticipation. I just wanted to finish the book so that I could get into my practice, and you know, I haven't been meditating for a few weeks because, I don't know, the holidays came along, I had a lot to do, and we just, these things happen. And I was so glad to read the book because it got me back to where I'm happiest.
All right. That's a very high compliment. Thank you very much.
Well, it's true.
That's exactly why I wrote the book. You know, as you know, having read it, you know, it actually gives instruction on how to meditate. It's not a theoretical book. It covers some real basic practices. So, that's its purpose, is to inspire people to meditate. And I think it's good for us.
Yes. So the first part of the book, you give several levels of the kind of meditation that you do and promote, and you start out with the easiest version, which really is very simple, and then you add, I don't want to say several layers of difficulty, but just a little more things to not think about. Because we don't want to be thinking, we don't want to apply effort, but we can do a few more things with the meditation in terms of adding mantras and adding more things to feel and go with. And they're easy. They really are easy. And then further on in the book, there's a bunch of other things that you talk about that I would like to touch on. Now, I started meditating really seriously in 2007. So I had been diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, 10 to 20% survival rate. I was already a vegan on a healthy diet. It didn't make any sense. And through a year and a half, I went through all kinds of stuff. But when it was time for the third surgery, because they made a mistake in the second surgery, not finding what they should have, I decided I really needed to do some extra special things, and I created this meditation program for myself, which worked really well. In fact, I have the blood test results that show that my tumor was shrinking when I started this meditation.
Wow.
Yeah. But I really enjoyed reading your method because mine was just something I just threw together and it worked. But I am now going to start investigating the things that you recommend because I think it'll only be good.
Well, great. I think it's wonderful that you explored it yourself and came up with a practice that worked for you and helped your health. That's just fantastic. And, you know, I think that's actually fairly rare because, I mean, before I ever received any instruction, this is way back, you know, when I was in high school back in the late 60s, I tried to meditate and I couldn't get anywhere with it. It wasn't until I was taught, and I think for most people that's really helpful. So more power to you if you actually had a practice that was working for you.
Yeah, well, you know, when I mean, I was very motivated.
Sure. Well, that's the best kind of meditator. In all my years of teaching, I love to get students that are really motivated. And when I first learned, I was really motivated because I was a mess, you know. So I needed meditation. And so this actually raises an interesting point. You know, people sometimes feel like they can't meditate because they can't have a quiet mind, or they maybe need some particular talent to be able to do it. And that's not true. You know, you can, the more in messed up, the more your mind is going wild, that the more important it is to meditate. You know, thinking that you have to have a certain talent to meditate is like thinking you have to be in perfect health to go to the doctor. You know, the doctor's there for those of us who need it, you know, so we all need meditation, and anyone can do it, even if your mind is just, you know, filled with thoughts all the time.
I do this show for a number of reasons, but I have a passion about food, and I really believe that food can help us reach a much better place in the quality of our lives, and it can do dramatic things to our personal health, the health of the planet, and certainly based on what we choose to eat, we can be a lot more compassionate to the other species that we share this planet with. But I also believe in nourishing the mind, the body, and the spirit, and from time to time, I talk about subjects like this, like meditation, because it's like food for the soul, food for the spirit, and it's the most important thing I think that we can do for ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, and just by the way, I talk a little bit about food in my book. I think that's very important too.
I was very happy, you know, to see that when I got there.
Yeah, it's incredibly important to our, you know, our health. And as a side note, it's also kind of has an impact on the quality of your meditation. So how you eat does affect the way your mind works, and it will affect the quality of your meditation. So eating, you know, really healthy, fresh, organic foods is certainly going to be, you know, it's going to be helpful for your mental health and for, you know, the depth and clarity of your meditation.
Now, something I was thinking about, which I don't think I thought about before, but I always like to see parallels in patterns in life, like there's some divine plan, and there are lots of different patterns that we can see on a microscopic level that repeat itself on a macroscopic level. I love that. And I was thinking about when it comes to food, when we're eating a standard American diet filled with lots of saturated fat, processed food, and lots of animal products, our arteries get really blocked and clogged. And then when you were talking about the chakras and purifying ourselves, we have a different, we have an energy blockage, and we're coated with all kinds of stuff that we need to clear and clean.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, that's a beautiful point. And actually, even in the writings of, you know, the ancient texts that come out of India, they talk about the effect of a poor diet will have an effect of blocking the nadis. And so that nadis, again, are these subtle channels in the body for the flow of subtle energy. And this flow of subtle energy is correlated with higher consciousness, greater clarity, greater joy, improved health, and all of that. So So again, it's all interrelated. You know, you if you eat poorly, you know, physically you're not going to feel the same energy. But also on the level of the energetic body, it can cause blockages. And so it just all it's all interrelated, all these different layers of our being.
Yes. Now, you and your wife both had health issues that you were able to resolve somewhat holistically through meditation and Reiki.
Right, right. Yeah, in the case of my wife, you know, she had a breast cancer, and we went to work with just the means that we had available before she, you know, took the route of, you know, further allopathic care. So we did Reiki on her twice a day. I was she actually has trained me as a Reiki master. She's been a Reiki master for many years. So I was doing Reiki on her, and she also did a lot of visualization of healing there. And then she went into the doctor, and he did the exam. And this, I forget what kind of exam, whether it was a X-ray or some other type of exam. But what he found was that where the tumor had been was now just a hole. And the vascular system that had fed the tumor was withering away. So, and he was just amazed because it hadn't been that long. It had only been a few weeks since his first exam and detection of the tumor. So this all happened very quickly. But yeah, so that's, that was an amazing approach. And then, let's see. Yeah, I had, what do they call it? Now I've
Hashimoto's.
Forgotten the name. Yes,
Hashimoto's.
That's right. So, and that's a big concern because basically our immune system is, eating away at the thyroid's ability to function. So it's going to knock off the thyroid, and then you're on, you know, thyroid medication the rest of your life. And so I didn't want to do that. So I adjusted my diet. And I think most importantly, I got rid of gluten. And sure enough, I forget how long a time passed, but the next time I was tested, I was free of the Hashimoto's, and that's considered an incurable illness. So that that was wonderful.
Yeah, well, I don't think anything's incurable.
Right. Yeah, it's so related to, you know, things that we think of as incurable diseases are often so related to stress and diet and things that we actually do have power to, you know, to amend in our life.
Now, so the first part of the book, you go in discussing how to meditate, and it, you know, for those of you who have tried and think you can't or are afraid to and think you can't shut down your mind, it's not about that at all. It's really effortless, like you write, and I recommend reading this just for that. Then the second part, you talk about a lot of different things, and one of the things was this childhood innocence that we should have when we're approaching everything in life, pretty much. And I was, it just made me wonder, do you think we have skills or some knowledge when we're born that we kind of shut down after a few years?
You know, I think you could look at it that way. I'm not an expert on child development, so I just want to say that my expertise is meditation. So I'm just, you know, taking a stab at this. But I think that we certainly do have a kind of wonderful innocence and awe and, you know, openness from early on. And that through our development, a lot of we can become somewhat jaded, and sort of layers of dross kind of covers that over to a degree, in varying degrees with different people, of course. But that is one of the things that I think meditation helps restore, because it takes you from those sort of crusty layers of conscious mind to much more delicate, subtle layers of thought and feeling where there is this freshness and this juiciness and vitality of just the sort of source of your being and life springing forth. And so you get connected with that, and it does give you a sense of freshness and innocence and openness and awe. It kind of restores that. So I think this is one of the great things about meditation.
What's great in your book is you're really very flexible. It's like it can be done this way, but if you can't do it this way, it's okay. And the bottom line is, you know, just do as much as you can and do it, and you know everything else will fall into place. Like you shouldn't meditate on a full stomach, but if you happen to have a full stomach and you don't have any other time to meditate, then it's okay to meditate on a full stomach. And
right.
I like that. Because, you know, people really get caught up in details and use them to keep them from doing what they need to do.
That's a great point. Yep, yep. We do tend to make excuses, and, you know, entropy can easily take over. So that's what I say, you know, it's ideal to meditate, say, 20 minutes or something, if you can get that in. But if you can't, even 5 minutes, you know, it's better than skipping it altogether. So at least you start to establish that pattern in your life where you are meditating regularly. However, whatever that length of time that works for you, you're doing it, and that's to be congratulated. And the funny thing is, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's a bit of a chore to meditate. But this is another misconception. It's actually a delight to meditate. And
yes.
And for your listeners, I just want to say, I'm not pulling your leg here. I'm not saying something that's wishful. If you're meditating in an easy, effortless way, and which will help it to actually do it what it's supposed to do, then you will feel a wonderful joy from the practice. It can be actually quite blissful. For instance, people will say, oh, Jayan, you know, you must have a lot of discipline to meditate every day. And, you know, it's not that at all. I'm a hedonist. It's like congratulating me for, you know, eating two big bowls of ice cream. Now, this might be the wrong station to say that on. But that's
well,
what
it could be coconut
I'm
ice cream.
It to. Yeah,
coconut
yeah
ice cream.
You know, I mean, two beautiful, great big, your favorite ice cream. That's what it feels like. It's a luscious experience. So don't think of it as a chore. But if it is a chore for you, then you might explore a little and find a different practice, because meditation, when it's working, it really is wonderful. So anyway.
It's funny that you mention ice cream, because when I did my yoga practice followed by meditation today, I wasn't ready to use the mantras that you recommended because I hadn't memorized them with my chakras. So I just did the first meditation that you recommended, going through the different chakras, and I didn't have a mantra, but the word dessert kept popping into my head. Like I was having dessert. I was doing my yoga and I kept saying, this is dessert. And through the meditation, it was, this is dessert. That's what it felt like. I was having dessert.
Great. Well, that is the perfect experience. So, wonderful.
Okay. So, let's see. Moving more towards some other things in the book. You know, thanks to the media, and I'm being sarcastic about this, and our culture in general, we pick up little things about transcendental meditation or meditation in general. We know nothing about these things, and we pick up little things like the mantra Om, and we can have a lot of fun with it and poke fun at it, but you are not recommending using Om. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. You know, just in brief, there's a whole science to mantras, so it's not ever recommended to just picking and choosing a mantra that you think might be nice. It's good to be taught, instructed by somebody who's really studied this, really understands that science of the mantras. And just in brief about Om in particular, okay, so Om is the sort of primordial sound. It's that primordial vibration of just like pure being, sort of unmanifest state before creation even really comes into existence. Just the like, again, that primordial state of being. So it's the vibration of the unmanifest, you could say. So if you're using Om a lot, you're basically increasing that vibration of the unmanifest in your life. And so things will start to fall away from you, different interests in the world and engaging with other people, family life, career. These kinds of things will start to appeal less and less to you because you're swinging in that vibration of the unmanifest. Now, this is great if you want to be a monk or a nun. And, of course, in the culture of India where, you know, renunciation has held a high place in spiritual life. So that's why the use of Om has been so prevalent in India. But in some quarters, it's even forgotten that that is the mantra that's ideal for that lifestyle. So you want to pick a mantra that is going to be supportive of, you know, a householder lifestyle, something where it supports that creative engagement in life and, you know, progression of desire towards more and more and more. So anyway, that's the kind of mantras that are appropriate for most people in the West and even most people in the East.
Something we need to learn a lot more about. There's a lot of magic in those sounds that I think that most of us, you know, have no clue about.
Right.
And then on the same subject of sounds, we have noise. And after reading your book, and you have a whole section of noise in meditation, I live in New York City. It is not a quiet town. And I was doing my meditation. I live right next to a park. And there's this one particular noise when the kids go down the slide. It sounds like the world is going to end. It's like beating on the biggest drum you can imagine. It's a huge noise. And I just heard that. And I smiled to myself because you told me that noise is okay when I'm meditating.
Right. Because, you know, noticing a sound in the environment, what is that? That's a thought. And so actually, you have to understand that thoughts are also okay. That those are also part of the meditation. And there's so much to be said about thoughts and meditation. Our attitude about thoughts in meditation tends to be like the biggest obstacle to being successful in your meditation. And so I devote like a whole chapter to this. But once you understand that thoughts are okay, and I really recommend if anybody's hung up on thoughts in meditation, please get the book, read that part especially because it will help you. And so anyway, then once you recognize thoughts are okay, then you have to it just follows naturally that also noises are okay because being aware of a sound in the environment is just another thought and that you treat it just like any other thought. It's fine that it's there. You just don't, you're not concerned with it. You just continue on with your practice. And so anyway, that's something that's really important.
Well, it helps us learn so much about ourselves and life in general because we could so easily fly off the handle from hearing some noise that's grating and annoying and sometimes some noises really are, but with just a simple acknowledgement of what it is and reflecting and a shift, we can still remain at peace.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I mean, over the years, I've meditated with buzz saws, with you name it, you know, loud heavy metal music, even pile drivers outside my window in Europe where they're building a resort right next to my building. You know, so I've meditated under all kinds of sounds. And whereas in the early days, some sounds really grated on me, like the buzz saw particularly, nowadays, you know, no sound makes any difference whatsoever. So you can definitely, you'll find that you may have an attitude about certain sounds, but eventually even that will dissolve and you'll find that it just doesn't matter at all. Most of the time, you won't even notice the sounds.
So we have less than a minute left, and I just wanted to say the thing that I love about meditation is that it's free, and it's a gift that we can give to ourselves every day. It's like dessert, only it's good for us, no calories, and it's just such a wonderful thing. And if you're afraid to get started, this Effortless Mind is really a wonderful book to read and learn how to do it and benefit so much from it. So thank you for writing it, Ajahn.
Well, thank you for having me. I love your attitude. I love it. Meditation is like dessert. That's the perfect thing for this show.
Well, I'm very grateful to your publicist, Susanna Gratz. She's directed me to numerous books that I've really enjoyed reading. So I'm grateful to her, and you picked a good one there.
Yep, Susanna is a great publicist. I love her. And again, Karen, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Okay, thank you. You've been listening to It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and have a delicious week.